Hello. I cannot say welcome back from vacation because we are not back, because there is no place to make you welcome, and because I fear that for many of us it has been anything but a vacation. Nonetheless, here we are, and I'm glad to have a chance to try to continue some form of teaching and learning. Let me spend a moment again on pedagogy. We are now aware that we will not meet again this term, and that by the time we do see one another again, the university and the society of which it is a part will be very different. Learning about the world of the law is a process which connects us always to the past, for the law has as one of its symbolic purposes the demonstration of continuity, the possibility that rules exist in a way which lies outside the particulars of time and space, equal justice for everyone, and rules that provide certainty in which we can believe are the basics of this magic of ours. And so to face a time like the one through which we are living, in which law remains more or less entirely the same, and yet everything comes to be different, is a reminder of the radical space between the world created by the law and the world in which people actually live, which is, of course, the subject of this week as we consider the meaning of the law in an open boat in the South Atlantic among four men who are dying together. The process of thinking about what it is to be in the world together and to be applying the law to it, with the law's remarkable capacity at one and the same time to promise continuity and to ignore change, is in itself a deeply ironic proposition. You may well have been conscious, as I was conscious reading Cannibalism and the Common Law, of a detail which has escaped me in all the previous times I've read this wonderful book, so many different years that I have spent with Brian Simpson's reconstruction, both of the voyage of the Mignonette and of the proceedings in the law at home. But never did it strike me, as perhaps it struck you too this time, that when Dudley, Stevens, and Brooks arrived in Falmouth in September of 1884, they were viewed with concern in part because of a cholera scare, an epidemic that was causing people to worry about travelers from abroad. I'd never really thought about the Moctezuma and the climate in Falmouth on that Saturday at the beginning of September as a time of epidemic before. It passed me by. And this time, as I was reading, it jumped out at me, and I realized that there was something that I hadn't understood before about the mood in which Dudley and Stevens found themselves first confronted by the majesty of the law. So this is part of what we learn from now, this condition in which we are. I'm not in a particularly optimistic mood about what we can achieve as learners together, not being together, meeting in a class that does not meet, thinking together without being together. I spent this break setting up and working in a mode that I have to admit I don't believe in. I hope that it will turn out as we go, that all of us can build some belief in what we are doing together. But one thing that I did understand, that I do now bring into our scattered and makeshift practice together is that this experience we are having can heighten our awareness even of the things that we thought we knew very well. Falmouth in September of 1884 now means something different to me than it has meant before. I've worked on the history of places suffering from epidemic disease. I've thought a lot about the mood of the parents in Northampton, Massachusetts in 1735 who had just finished burying their children in a moment of horrendous smallpox in the town, and how they treated their pastor, Jonathan Edwards, when he told them that the epidemic was the work of an angry God against the depraved sinners that they were, and they ran him out of town and sent him off to Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where no doubt they hoped the Indians would do away with him. I've thought about the life of epidemic disease even in New York City in the 18th century, and even so, I don't understand, or didn't anyway, what it means to be looking at a strange ship and an odd tale and a missing boy and a bunch of heroic survivors in the midst of, well, the fear of what we all now fear, the death and pain and loss and chaos and destruction that illness wreaks upon the pride and self-sufficiency of human society. I guess that what I mean to say from this is that although our means of learning are badly injured by the state in which we find ourselves, and even though we have a ton of other things to think about, and unfortunately, as a society, an immense amount of pain to feel, still there is something in this from which we can derive some benefit of learning. I hope that the addition of the journals will provide you with a way to reach some form of direct contact between you and me, in which you can both seek specific advice or assistance with the work you're doing, and also to help me learn from your own experience of what we are doing together what would work better, or what should be done. I admit that I'm not going to Zoomify this course under any circumstances this time around. If you demonstrate as you go in your journals and in other forms of conversation with me that Zoomification is superior to what I'm doing, I will try and invent something else superior to Zoomification. I can't make synchronous video conferencing the center of this form of teaching. It seems to me merely a simulacrum of the face-to-face work, as Leff would put it, that teaching really is. But I do want to know the ways in which our forms of intermediated contact, our ways of using computers, the ones I started to think about in India in 2012 and that I'm now trying to use for an entire course and two entire courses and an entire term for the first time. I do want to know the ways in which these structures do and don't work for you and could or couldn't be improved upon in this state in which we find ourselves. I will say again, I think that listening unbroken to my effort to speak my way through the entirety of what ought to be a dialogue in the classroom is a bad idea. Give it a rest from time to time. Take notes or look out the window or do something completely different and more immediately useful, and then return. You won't forget where we were, and the tape can always be rewound. Give the thought to the criticism sometimes advanced by some of you in the classroom that I was hiding the ball. I thought about that a good deal over the break as I tried to plan out how these impromptu moments together would work, as I tried to prepare my way into a very different experience than the one I usually have in the classroom. And I came back to that occasional half jocular criticism that I am given to hiding the ball, and I wondered what it is about this kind of teaching I am now doing that I should think of as the opposite of hiding the ball. For, of course, nothing can hide the ball now. I see that experience as finding the ball, not hiding it. That is to say, expecting the dialogue of students and teacher and the flow of question and answer and idea and objection and pushback, not as an attempt to discover something hidden, but as an attempt to discover something actually only available in the relationship between us. Socrates gets it wrong too. Well, Plato gets his imaginary Socrates getting it wrong in the supposition that knowledge is pre-existing. There is, in that sense, a ball to be hidden. I have thought about Dudley Stevens and the boat quite a lot over the decades, reinforced in what I know about each of them and their measurements as men and things, because Brian wrote this amazing book. But in the end, it isn't what I have thought that turns out to be the learning. It is the discovery of something there, wherever there might be, in that space I cherish now that we've all lost it, that spot where all our eyes can meet and words hang in the space between the floor and the ceiling just long enough to turn into something else mid-flight as they move from one of us to another or to all. At any rate, I cannot begin as I would like to begin in the room by setting up possibilities and watching them reverberate. It's flatter than that. The process of reading in three dimensions that I referred to while we could still see one another is now a process of listening in three dimensions, making, not absorbing. Even though I'm compelled to be more flat-footed and to say in some simple declarative way what I think this episode in the history of the human race means, this meeting between the people of the sea and the people of the law, even though I have to spell it out, if you like, still what I am saying at this moment, what is being picked up and recorded as I look at the river and the rain and the nature of my village, this part of the Upper West Side of Manhattan Island where I have, where I was a child, where I grew up, where I've spent almost all my life, in its new and empty and different and unfathomably suspended condition. It seems to me that this world of mine hangs on a string between everything that was and everything that is about to be. 100 years ago, my mother's father lost his mother as a 13-year-old boy in the influenza epidemic of 1919. And he and his slightly older brother, without their father since his death in an accident 10 years before, and without their mother now, became boys in the street, runaways from an abusive stepfather and his new wife, and began their lives, Charlie and Eddie, these two boys in the street, these two ragamuffin kids, beginning what was the line down which my mother came and wrought her majesty on the world and gave me a chance to have a life and become something. But all of it, I know, shaded in a way by that orphan boy's pain and suffering and fear and hope. This place that I have spent so much of my life in is now about to make more loss and to provide more chance to lose and to rebuild. And here in this moment, this time when we were together at the beginning of your life as lawyers happens to be the moment in which that occurs. Suddenly a wave comes, a force of nature beyond our power to do anything about, and staves in our boat. And here we are. And anything that is said about that is but small beer. Our words come up against the reality of that, and they are barely anything. I know, as surely as Tom Dudley knew on the morning of the 6th of July, 1884, 2,000 miles from the South American coast, 700 miles from two tiny specks of land to north and southeast of him, that we are destined for a fate that over which we have no power, and that it is fortune and the grace of God only that we survive. To understand that is not to be in a lawyer's frame of mind. The lawyer's frame of mind, whether better or worse, is far more definitive. It wishes to poke holes in something for the benefit of the client. It wishes, if not to control circumstances, at least to edge them, to improve marginally, to foresee a little, to provide against some contingencies, to do some pointed or at least shaped human thing in order to make a system of symbols, a bunch of rules, order out of chaos, as Carl Wiley would say, to make some human little distance out of some vast and impossible human set of circumstances. This, I suggested, lo, these many weeks ago in another world, is really the purpose of magic. That the reduction of the inconceivable to the fully conceived, the immensity of the unknown and the total unpredictability of the world, the fragility of human life, and the meaninglessness of our struggles into meaning, not only into meaning, but into control, not only into control, but into power. This is the work, the dual work, the combined work, the similar work of magic and the law. So it isn't the lawyer's way of thinking to say, here we are in this chaos that will overwhelm us, in which tens or hundreds of thousands of people whose lives touch our own in the 6 degrees of separation sense, who are our society, our community, and our world, they're going to die. Jobs in their millions, tens of millions, will be lost. Businesses built by care and chance-taking and bravery and preparation and just sheer determination to keep going will be snuffed out. And those who have to take the weight for it, those who will do the suffering and the losing, and who will wonder how to keep their children fed and warm, well, like Dudley and Stevens, Brooks and Parker, they will be working men and women. people whose role it is to wring their living from the world by the permission of those who own. And we, whether we own a lot or nothing at all, we will be lawyers. And not only will we expect to be able to edge the rules, to exercise control, to perform the magic of making things happen in society using words, not only will we have a bag of spells, but we will see the fear in the eyes of people in the street who don't have any magic to bring to bear, whose only hope is that the world around them, man-made and natural, microbiotic and macroeconomic, will allow them somehow to wring a living from the world, to support their families, and to go on and survive another generation. But a lawyer's mind, tuned to the immediate happenings of society, inscribing upon them the spells she knows, the forms of power he's been taught to wield, a lawyer's mind embraces all that uncertainty and all that fear and doubt and courage and complexity, well, in a flattening embrace, puts it on the Procrustean bed of the law and cuts it into the form in which it can be delivered for the purposes of the maintenance of principle. This, after all, is what the story of the other side of the Mignonette's voyage is about. It's about the nature of the law's power to inscribe. Dudley and Stevens aren't being prosecuted for murder, or even, I think, though this will be an important thing for us to come to conclusions about ultimately, for cannibalism. They aren't being prosecuted, indeed, for themselves at all, really. They're being made to represent the possibility of an idea. And next time, when we think about the world of the law and the lawyers on the land, we shall be mostly concerned with the question, what is it that they are trying to turn these men into a message over? Clear enough that in the end there needs to be a leading case on survival cannibalism. Clear enough indeed if you have read the portions of Brian's book about the Euxine and the preceding efforts of the British law to come to a firm conclusion for the books about why we must not eat one another. Clear enough that a leading case is what this is, a set of dramatic facts upon which storytelling can be worked and the world of the law can be made more whole. But just to wander through that process, through Baron Huddleston's extraordinary manipulativeness, which is really just a trial judge doing his job in a heightened form of what every trial judge must do, or what it means to be a servant of the legal principle, regretting that this means a good man might die at the end of a rope, or what it means indeed to be conducting what amounts to a lengthy simulated execution of Tom Dudley and Edwin Stevens, not in order ultimately to hang them, but in order to affirm the possibility of hanging them. That all of this is what the lawyer's mind is when applied to the events in the South Atlantic, or at any rate what it is to be everybody except the defense counsel. What it is to want to read the shorthand notes. What it is to have the job of picking holes in what is made of whole cloth to begin with. But all of that, not just the Arthur Charles of it or the Baron Huddleston of it, not just the Home Office's role or the nature of what it means to be a juror, but the whole of it, the drama of the law is a sham, meaningful and powerful and beyond everybody's sense of depth, profound, and yet still a sham. As a magic spell is a sham, as the act of teaching a class that does not meet is a sham, as our formative experiences in life are, in one or another sense, performances, dramas in our heads, but always with the background of the absoluteness of, well, death, hell, and the grave. All of it, as Ahab says in a different sea story altogether, being just a pasteboard mask behind which are the realities of the world. Tom Dudley went to sea at 9 years old. His mother dead, his father a working class mariner. Tom Dudley went to sea at 9 years old and was himself the boy. As all the young boys of Itchen Ferry, where Richard Parker grew up, went in part to sea, living partly by the yachting community's need for working class mariners and partly by the oyster farmers' need for men in boats, but always with an understanding that a boy goes to sea and makes himself a man. Dudley is a brave boy. It was true when he was a kid working the yachts on the Clyde. It was true when he came to become a mate and at long last with the assistance of his wife, the schoolmaster, 7 years his senior, became able to pass the exam that he had failed multiple times before to be rated a mate for sailing vessels. Tom Dudley was a brave man. People saw that in him. Though, as Simpson points out, even a yacht master in a nice piece of work is still just a gentleman's gentleman, a butler on the water for the people who own. But they see in him pluck, and sometimes bravery more than pluck, and maybe even courage more than bravery, something that sets him out as as a young man who could lead men. And he feels it in himself too, no doubt. In his piety, in his honest candor. He's not a man who wishes to blame others for his mistakes, or who won't take a chance to better himself or to do his job. He, no doubt, never considered himself a hero, but perhaps we should say of him, as a Peruvian policeman says in one of the finer political dramas of the beginning of the 21st century, you consider yourself perhaps a Gary Cooper type. If Tom Dudley had known the future and had known the Gary Cooper type, he might have considered himself one of it. But all of them, Dudley and Stevens and Brooks and Parker, they are men of work, separated by an enormous class distinction, that which draws a line between officers like Dudley and Stevens and mere seamen like Brooks and Parker. They belong at different ends of the boat, if you like, before the mast and behind it, in the cabin, on the forecastle. But in their different classes of work, they're working men. And all, to one degree or another, save perhaps Brooks, emigrants in training. For one of the things which does strike you as you read Bryan's effort to bring together these men for their voyage is that they, three of the four of them at least, and probably Brooks too, they all believe that lives lie for them out in Australia, in the colonies, away. Even Dudley, himself relatively successful in his professional life, and married to a woman of stable professional, you know, status and exertion, even Dudley thinks that Sydney is somehow the beginning of a new life altogether. Stevens, too, wishes to move his family to Australia. He's putting off telling his wife that he wants the kids and her to come to Australia with him. But when he springs the news by message from Madeira and his wife says yes, by message to be carried by the steamer to Cape Town, where she expects him to pick it up. She already, even though it hasn't been officially proposed, seems to have understood that their family's destiny now lies in emigration. We are now particularly conscious, as the folk of Falmouth were only a few months later, and for the same reason, we are now particularly conscious of the meaning of migration in the human world. We've shut down the travel of the world at the moment when we are the first generation for whom all the world lay open a few hours distant. The immense migration of the human race, its ceaseless wandering, its endless desire to know what lies over the horizon has always been there. This species of Pithecine primate overwhelmed the world precisely because its feet are always itching. The migration of the human race brought the 16-year-old homeless boy who was my father's father to New York in the fall of 1913, when all they worried about was people bringing in the occasional disease, the little scruffiness of the European undermasses. But that migration, that desire to go elsewhere, which we have both enabled beyond all previous imagining and now, in the space of just a couple of weeks, closed down. That, too, seems to rise up in relief as I read this story another time and think again about what it meant that all of those men, even Brooks, who Dudley promises there will be work in Sydney and has a professional seaman's understanding that the world is wide and you can go here and go there and go anywhere. All of them, one way or another, they see that Australia they are going to as not merely a place to deliver John Want's boat, but as the beginning of another existence, a new frame of life. And so there they are. Dudley as master, in command for the first time of an ocean-going vessel, leaving behind his life as a butler to the wealthy yachting crew of the English South or the Clyde or some other part of the island than his Essex home roots. Dudley, with a business to conduct, he has a sum of money to get this boat to Sydney, and it was first his idea that there should be three aboard, not four. And he thought that the repairs that the mignonette needed were ones that he should perform economically, because the less he spent on men and wood, the more he would be able to spend on a new life for himself and his family in Australia. It's clear that something more than just stress of weather destroyed the mignonette. And I think that Brian Simpson's judgment, which, like all historians' judgments, is nothing but a guess, a way we understand collective documented memory by synthesizing out of it, as every human being does all the time with every kind of memory, some new reality, a guess about who we are. But Brian's guess, I think, is highly probable, that the mignonette came apart where its planks cut loose from the keel, in the very place where Dudley had decided whether old wood or new beams should be used. The mignonette is not a tiny vessel. I mean, tiny compared to the world of the Southern Ocean, but still. 52 feet, 30 tons, roughly speaking, with some disagreement. When I was a boy in 1966, when I was 7 years old, Sir Francis Chichester sailed single-handedly around the world in the Gypsy Moth 4, a sailing vessel only a foot longer than the mignonette. Solidly built, at least so it seemed, in the year that Richard Parker was born, 1867, the mignonette's a vessel capable of going to Australia. But it had been, in its last 2 years of life, rather blown upon. And when Dudley converted it from a yawl back to a cutter by removing its mizzenmast and resetting the decking, he had decisions to make about how to spend the budget that the owner had given him. And perhaps he decreed its doom right there. He wasn't himself a shipwright, and he had never sailed a boat 16,000 miles from Great Britain to Australia. And his judgments were affected by his business needs. But he was responsible. In all senses, he was responsible. And when events decreed that that responsibility became overwhelmingly heavy, he maintained it. Stevens is an unluckier man in many ways. Acquainted professionally with the consequences of getting it not quite right, that's certain and for sure. His earlier experiences had left him somewhat, well, I wouldn't say damaged goods exactly, but his reputation had a mark on it. His fender was dented from the Europa. And therefore, he too saw a better life abroad. It was good that Dudley decided to employ a mate. The nature of the relationship between Dudley and Stevens is not the ampersand in the title of a leading case. It wasn't equality either, of course. Dudley may be escaping being a gentleman's gentleman in the world of yachting, but he's the master, no doubt of that. And he keeps that role even once catastrophe has brought them to a stage in which, in their little boat, the dinghy, the punt, the little thing without a name of its own, in which the sphere of their death and salvation is to be played out, even there, whereby the tradition of maritime life, Dudley has no more authority than anybody else, save that of his personality. That of his personality says the tale. But Stevens, who has more navigation capability than Dudley does and understands the deep blue water of the world better than Dudley does, he was a partner in this matter, as he is a partner in the history of the law to the man who made the decision. They are both sir to the other two, and yet, in the end, not from the authority of position and surely not from the decisions of the owner, John Want, but from the nature of his nature, Dudley remains the man who calls the tune. When England likes to think well of itself, which it was doing just a few weeks ago before the virus came to make even Boris Johnson humble, when England likes to think well of itself, it thinks it's made of Tom Dudley's, does it not? He's the embodiment of the stiff upper lip and the keep calm and carry on and the unflappable and the workmanlike and the well-prepared and, well, none of them is literary, but compared, say, to Richard Parker, who could not sign his name and for whom Dudley drafts his one letter home, Dudley is a possessor of the English language, the most important part of the English language, the Book of Common Prayer. He leads his religious service on board the Mignonette every Sunday morning till the one that found them in the boat. But that desire to represent itself as a society of Tom Dudley's is also Tom Dudley's desire to embody what he might think of not as an England, but as a role. His speech, as everybody notices, tells where he's from, his place and class, that Essex accent, its breadth always a little bit of a provocation to the speakers of upper-class English. But also a plainness and clarity that is reflected everywhere in what he does. You can see it in those crucial moments, those brief quarter of an hour in which the Mignonette gave up its life and Dudley saved that of his people all at once. What came upon the Mignonette came with all of them awake and active. A suddenness of storm and a suddenness of destruction in which four men all participated all at once, and yet. Stevens and Dudley became aware within seconds of one another that the Mignonette had been destroyed, that its side had broken loose, that it was holed or some other way brought to sinking. Within seconds, they had recognized it, and they knew that they had only minutes in which to save their lives. Suddenly, a Saturday afternoon had become the moment in which every action determines everything else. And they did reasonably well. But we have to understand that the simple stress of weather, as Dudley put it in the loss report, that destroyed the Mignonette, left them a boat that could not swim in a sea that at any moment could destroy it. The boat, the punt, the dinghy, the vehicle of their death and salvation, now there, that's a little thing. 13 feet long, 4 feet wide, 20 inches deep. barely a large log afloat in the Atlantic, and made of mahogany boards a quarter of an inch thick. It's honest lumber. Let us say it's really a quarter of an inch. And still. So they cut it loose from where it was hanging upside down above the fore cabin of the Mignonette, threw it in the sea, and by the time it arrived on its keel below, it had already a hole in it. Keeping the punt from sinking is now the single most important task that they will have day in, day out, as they slowly die of dehydration over the next 24 days. There was originally a bunch of cotton batting pushed into the hole. And then on the Sunday, the 6th of July, which began their odyssey, Dudley cut off the bottoms of his trousers to make a better cloth patch for that hole. But it is always part of the thinking that follows that this dinghy, if it is not kept head to sea, will be swamped, being only 20 inches deep. It's a saucer, not a boat, right? The birch bark canoe of the Algonquin people of the Canadian U.S. boundary waters is deeper than that. And yet, if they can avoid tipping it over or breaking a hole in it, if they can keep it trimmed by sitting always two and two, fore and aft, well, then they can survive long enough to die. And so they get it in the water, and then they must provision it. But who are they? For Dudley, of course, wants everybody else off the Mignonette within a moment. Parker threw the water butt into the sea and lost their drinking water. But it was a judgment which made sense. Probably the conflicting testimony on this should be evaluated as Parker didn't do that of his own accord. Dudley told him to throw the water butt in the sea. It would float, and if lowered carelessly into the dinghy, it could have staved another hole in the boat, and then they'd all have died. So Parker threw the water butt into the sea, expecting to catch it with the dinghy once they were there. And they tossed the tins of turnips, all they had, into the water. where one was lost and two were recovered. And then everybody but Dudley is in the boat. He, being captain, was left last, as he should, in his own judgment have been, to take all the risk. He heaves the compass and rips the binnacle off the deck and tosses that to them in the dinghy, and then goes below for his compass and for his sextant and his last bit of navigation hardware. At risk of instant death, at risk of being trapped, if the minionette turns over, he is gone. Water up to his chest beneath, below, the boat already sinking, moments only available. And he is down below looking for his instruments, floating in their cases in the water that threatens to rise to his chin and that could swallow him in a moment. All the presence of mind, all the clarity of thought and purpose, every bit of the courage that he had ever showed, all at once, displayed in a fashion that even a lawyer could admire, it seems to me. After all, who better at a moment like that? Carl Wiley, Robinson, or Tom Dudley? Like the nurses and the doctors straining themselves against their exhaustion, against their growing illness, against their fear of bringing contagion home to their families, against the sheer weight of watching people die, you wish that you had some way of saving. Dudley's struggle in those brief moments, which at one level we could call just the instinct of survival, and at another we could call just what the captain is supposed to do, is, of course, the presence of a state of personality capable of both courage and sacrifice. And he showed that, as he showed other things in the boat. But whatever it is, it's not unlearned. It's not pure instinct only, after all. Any more than the work of the nurses and the doctors is mere instinct. He practices a skilled trade. Those who go down to the sea in ships have different pieces of it. His piece isn't navigation, mostly, or sailing blue water, mostly. It's keeping the boat swimming. It's managing it all. And he has reached for a long trip. Not just a voyage, but a change of life, of which he believes himself fully capable, and in the emergency, he is. All of them, well, not Richard Parker, who is learning, but all of them who have experience, Dudley and Stevens and Brooks, they have an act to perform every single hour of every day of their remaining likely lives, just to steer the boat directly into the head to sea posture. That's what they must do at all times. They have to keep the boat headed direct into the sea. If they don't, if they allow the swell to come across them, they will sink utterly and immediately in this tiny little shell, this leaky blog that they are in. And no amount of debilitation, no amount of dehydration, no amount of physical discomfort, no sleep or inattention can ever be allowed to overwhelm the need to steer the boat. Dudley it is who rigs the sea anchor that prevents them from being immediately overwhelmed. Dudley it is who convinces them and who sacrifices his own shirt for a sail to try and hasten their endless voyage towards South America, their hope that 2,000 miles of sea can be crossed, or that at least enough of it that they can fall into the lanes of sailing ships crossing the Atlantic twice to get to the Indian Ocean, driving west and south by south across the Atlantic past Tristan da Cunha, and then catching the trades at 40 degrees south to push themselves across the Atlantic and into the Indian Ocean. That's the way the big sailing vessels move, not down the coast of Africa as Dudley is planning, which is how the small boats go. And so Dudley is pushing this little thing, you can not even really call it a vessel, as fast as he can go, some 10 sea miles a day, let us suppose, in those shirts, while constantly steering with Brooks and Stevens in turn through the 24 hours to make sure that never are they headed anywhere except into the swell head on. And all of this is being done by men who know that if they fail, they die. All the time. Reading the sea and the wind and steering their unsteerable little boat with their blocks of wood as sea anchor and their rear boards pushed up to catch the wind and these shirts to fill. And that's it. That's what stands between them and an instant solitary death. But that's not the reason that there is a story of Dudley and of Stevens. On the other side, there's that question of the way that such men have to keep themselves alive. And here too, of course, the literature, the folklore, the shanties, the understandings of what it means to be in a situation where one man's body may be necessary to sustain the others is always in their minds. The accounts differ about this that they gave over the years, Brooks's testimony, Stevens' recollections, Dudley's storytelling to Philippa, which she wrote down and made available, all these different accounts, all of them sitting in the public records office in the shoebox of the British Empire, all there to be consulted. I spent many an hour when I was young in the PR myself reading documents from long ago and far away. The little dramas of the archives are all different and never all that dramatic, or at any rate like all the documents of historical archives, never the whole story or even a story you would want to claim is the whole one. But much as I can see the old round room and the long room at the PRO in Chancery Lane, and where all this was when Simpson wrote his book, or the much more modern glass and concrete archives built later out at Kew, much as I can see the core of bored historians working their way through one document, still I find it hard to imagine what it is to be Brian Simpson, with whom I sat in those archives at different times, reading those accounts of how it was that Parker came to die. Exactly what it means to be sitting, reading two-dimensionally in the archives, trying to bring into being the three dimensions of that boat and the men in it. It's not that I don't know how it is done, in the same way that you are beginning to understand how lawyering is done. You get a little experience and you get a little more, and pretty soon you find yourself doing the things you used to read about. But even so, any individual example, like any adroit cross-examination well conducted, or any appellate argument particularly beautifully balanced and pushed through despite the pressure of the judges to break it up into little things that they can handle, those moments of the transcendence of the ordinary skill into the particular magic of creation, to see Simpson working the sources around the particular accounts of the death of Parker is a thing of special beauty, one magician looking at another's trick. And even so, of course, the most important part, which maybe you can guess, I think Frank Putnam can help us to understand, is how the differing accounts reflect not merely the uncertainties of expression or the shifting of self-protective attitude, but actually the changing of state. We don't have enough to understand completely all those pieces of all those men's minds as these horrible experiences move through. We can say that from the beginning they are aware that their rescue is improbable, that their death is very likely, and that there is no water to drink. 24 days in an open boat is not the record, not by a long shot. During the Second World War, Poon Lim, who was a cabin steward on a passenger liner, sunk in the Atlantic Ocean, lived 133 days on a raft, all by himself. He didn't have a fish hook to start out with, and he had little to drink also. But it is the water which is the end and being of life. The water in which you now, like me, wash your hands all the time, as we try to stay alive and to avoid bringing disease and death to other people, and we take for granted the water in which we wash, though we should not. Without the water in which we wash, our deaths and the deaths of other people would be far more likely, and overall the arithmetic of death would be certain. Without the water they have not to drink, they will die. And they have less water than they think, because they are convinced of a scientific falsehood. Not like the President of the United States assuming that one or two malaria drugs will suddenly magically cure the COVID-19. Not a mere whimsy, but a well-established cultural fact, common sense, what everybody knows. It isn't true, but it's common sense and everybody knows it. Seawater is poisonous. If you drink it, you will die. So they have all around them poison in the guise of water, which they know as though it were as much a fact as how a compass reads or how a dinghy behaves in a heavy sea, which they know will kill them if they drink it, and they have nothing but their own urine to drink. Now we learn, we say we do at any rate, scientifically, how to save ourselves. We study and we learn and we teach and we understand, and of course, even at that, even the wealthiest and best educated societies on earth do not learn. Not really. That's why you and I are where we are right now. Not, I mean, not in class together. That could happen to almost anyone. No, I mean that where we are this moment, as we are not quite talking to one another, waiting for the hospitals to fill and all the respirators to be used and no PPE left in many a hospital cupboard, and, well, as we wait for deaths to begin. We are, after all, in that boat now, aren't we? Like Dudley and Stevens and Brooks and Parker. We have not what we require to survive. And soon, the people who must choose will be making choices about who lives and who dies. Usually, when we read this case, we are not in the boat. That's the lawyer's way of thinking. The boat is there, and we are here. We see that very clearly once they are home again, magically transported back. The law is here, the boat is there. And it's that alternation between the there and here, between the power of the Englishman's law to reach into a boat in the South Atlantic and to declare fatuously but certainly, scientifically, with analytical presence of mind, that they should have let themselves starve to death rather than have killed and eaten Parker. Ordinarily, whether we are necessarily quite in tune with the fatuous certainty of the opinion, whether we are in the crimes course given to say that the law ought not to state impossibilities like that and make an ass of itself, or whether we are given on the whole to agree that some aspiration should be expressed towards civilization, if you please, that we should have principles and apply them evenly, that there is no defense of necessity in homicide, whatever it is we think, our ability to think it depends ultimately upon the belief that the law is here and the boat is there. But reading either the case, Regina against Dudley and Stevens, or the story of the case, Regina against Dudley and Stevens, now, right now, in our places where we are, apart where we are, together where we are, right now, it's impossible to say the law is here and the boat is there. For we are in the boat, all of us, the whole of the human race in the boat, watching as we come day by day by day closer to the moment at which we too will have to allow somebody working hard at her job to say, well, we haven't enough all to survive. We must make choices. Some must die that others may be saved. All these last several days, as I've read again and prepared again and got ready to say what I am saying now, I have known two things. That the law can only misdescribe what is in the boat. That's what I always know. And that the condition of being in the boat is a universal condition. That's what I have never known with the clarity with which I and you and all of us know it now, if we can cease to dissociate long enough to see the near future of our people and our world. But that's where they are, in the boat, where Parker has drunk seawater and is therefore known, scientifically known, commonsensically known, to be dying anyway. And where they are all, indeed, dying anyway. 24 days in an open boat, well, that's not the record. And you can survive progressively weaker and more subject to other forms of death by recycling all the liquid that your kidneys release. With a little additional seawater and a few ounces a day of rainwater, death can be long in coming. But it cannot be indefinitely postponed. They were dying from the moment that they entered the boat. Perhaps, as Brian suggests, they were dying from the moment the Mignonette left home water. But surely they were dying from the moment they were in the boat. And Dudley knows that, and he is managing their lives and their deaths with the same daily skill that Stephen shows and Brooke shows too, men of the water, living on the water, but without water to drink, and therefore dying every day. That there might come a moment when they would have to drink the blood not of a turtle but of a man is evident to all of them. As they know, remarkably, they know how it is that they should use the body of Parker best to keep themselves alive. Because this too is information possessed not in one man's mind or in four men's minds, but in the collective understanding of the people who live on the sea. It's not, I think, unreasonable to say that murder is the charge, but not the offense, about which the law busies itself with Dudley and with Steve. But let us leave the lawyers on the land to say their say later, and to say that it isn't Richard Parker's death which concerns those who survived him. They thought his death inevitable, and it was. They thought him dying faster than they were, and he was. They thought the logic of survival was those who have wives and children who could become destitute and be themselves ruined if these men did not come back from the sea, they thought that logic irresistible. And in their culture, it was. The men who would leave dependents to starve without them should survive, though Dudley knows perfectly well that Philippa will survive if he dies. When he writes to her, he doesn't write in doubt about her ability to survive or to feed their daughters. He writes to say, you should know what happened to your Tom, your loving husband. But still, they know that Parker is the one whose death is least harmful and most certain both. It isn't Parker's death that concerns them in that sense. And this is why for Dudley to report the death of Parker like the loss of the Mignonette, what happened to the boat, stress of weather, what happened to the boy, killed. That's just the facts of life as he understands it at the point of death. But the cannibalism, this is something else. Here, too, when he must, Dudley is as candid and clear as he can be. The boy was killed and eaten to sustain the existence of those who remained. No doubt, with some sense of the diction of his schoolmaster wife, not in exactly his own most natural words, but also meant in the same way that he means what he reads every Sunday morning from the sublimity of the Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer. Here, the grandeur of Dudley is in the simplicity with which tragedy is conveyed. Well, what can we say about that which is enacted in the most solemn drama of the religion of his life, the one in which there is a sacrifice and we accept the body and the blood as the sign of redemption? This is not merely what is at the base of the Mass or at the base of the myth of the Christian miracle. It isn't just there, it's everywhere. The two great hidden meanings in all of Judaism, the two unsayable things that lie beneath the realities that the Old Testament and its intellectual outcome give to the Jewish people, the two unsaid things are about polygamy and human sacrifice. And it is not merely our two religions from that one corner of the Abrahamic world in which that structure of sacrifice and redemption and the consumption of the sacrifice, not its burning on the altar, not its leading up in the smoke to the nostrils of the gods, but that moment of that consumption of the sacrifice, that dubious matter always in the law of sacrifice, the actual eating. But in that eating is redemption. It says, Brooks, we were new men after we drank the blood of Parker. And Stevens and Dudley, they know. They cut out the heart and the liver and they ate them immediately fresh. And from this they gained, well, the chemicals with which to live. Dudley wants everything preserved, except perhaps those last remnants of the corpse of Parker, that one rib, that little bits of flesh. Because although of nothing is he ashamed, of some things is he reticent. Like the accident with the chamber pot that occurred to him on Moctezuma and that cut him up and combined blood and shit for Captain Simonson to help him through. The dirt of it leaves him queasy. But for the redemptive meaning of the sacrifice, he has no doubt at all. And the shanties tell how it's to be done. And how do they know how to dismember a body on the oarlocks of the boat, the little bits of brass that won't be cut or broken by the activity of dismembering Parker? Because all of this is collectively known, because it's part of the folklore of their trade. This is why Brian's use of the shanties is so valuable and important, to show the nature of the culture What, me, sir? They've seen it so many times. It's drawn in tintype in the prints on their walls. Of course, in those pictures, it is Abraham and Isaac. But it means to them what it does not mean to the lawyers and their minds on land. So let us leave it there for today. We will meet in virtual online chat room space later today to talk about this, and I hope that there will be many things that you too will want to say. And come Thursday, we all think about the lawyers and their approach to this act of sacrifice and redemption, death, hell in the grave, resurrection and survival. And we, unlike almost all who came before us, we will know that we too are in the boat. I wish you safety, and I wish you health. Talk to you soon.